Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Read Right to Left podcast. I am G, joined by my always wonderful co-host, Ray, from Whimsical Pictures.
Hi, everyone.
And this month, we are doing a series spotlight, one that I had previously read and am a big fan, one that was new to Ray, but we are both fans of this particular creator. This month we are talking about Yuki Kamitani's debut work, Nobari no O.
Yes, and we have actually done an author spotlight episode on this creator already. I'm sure you'll probably link that below if people are watching on YouTube.
Yes. And we mentioned, or I mentioned the series a little bit during that spotlight episode, or that creator spotlight episode, but I think we'll really dive into the nitty-gritty with this one. So, Ray, as this was your first time reading this series, how was your reaction? How did you feel throughout your experience?
Well, I always find it interesting to, like, go back to the earlier works of a creator that I love. I think that's why you originally, like, went back and read, picked up and read Nobari no O as well. Because obviously I'm a big fan of Our Dreams at Dusk and an even bigger fan of Shonen Note, which has been licensed, and y'all better pick it up when it comes out. my choir children will be available in English. But today we are talking about my ninja children. So picked up the entire series for, like, $10 at Book Off and proceeded to not read it until for preparation for this. And I enjoyed it a lot. The first few volumes, I think you can tell, like, their art style is, first of all, quite different from how it is now. And also, there's some fresh and funky, like, 2008, 2007 fashions going on. and it was interesting, I think, watching their art journey throughout the series. Watching their work get more sort of streamlined, watching them get more confident in their ability to show over telling. So that was just, and then seeing, like, a lot of their pet themes in later series get explored in this one as well, you know. They are certainly a creator with a very strong point of view and a few things that they very much want to get across with their work and explore with their work that they keep coming back to. And this series is no exception. Also, their obsession with drawing birds and cats. but yeah, I had a lot of fun. That's it. I had fun. I enjoyed it a lot. Dense as the first few volumes were. It was fun. I definitely had read, like, the first volume and, like, random chapters back when Yen originally released the series. I remember I used to pick up their magazine, Yen Plus or whatever, and that was one of the series that ran in it. So I would always kind of, like, flip through it without really knowing what was going on in order to, you know, to get to my Soul Eater or whatever I was reading. So it's like I was aware of the series. I definitely remembered it. Like, I don't know if it's Soul Eater or something else from that era that anime was coming out. That, like, it was one of my first anime box sets and it has the Nobari no O, like, preview on it.
Yeah.
So, like, it never left my memory. It's always been there. I just never, like, until G went back and picked it up, I did not, it didn't register to me at all that that was Kamitani.
Mm-hmm. I think that seems to be the case with most people. They may have heard of the series, have, like, a vague awareness, might know it as, like, not necessarily super popular, but it has quite a dedicated following, or did make a little bit of waves in certain communities, but I don't necessarily think a lot of people who are now fans of Kamatani's manga through Our Dreams at Dusk and maybe Hiraeth and hopefully Shonen Note going forwards actually knows that this is also a series from this creator that is, although an early work and quite different plot-wise to some of their later titles, it is very similar in a lot of the messaging and themes that it has, and so does fit quite well into their overall library of titles, if that makes sense. You can see how this series was quite foundational to them developing maybe more confidence in the type of stories that they'd later go on to write. And really see the growth of their storytelling and character writing and all of that through the series. Although I will say that even from the beginning, it feels like Kamatani did know the trajectory of the series. They weren't making it up as they went along. Everything is very well established, which makes it quite well-rounded by the end of it. So even though there's an evolution of especially art and story writing, it doesn't feel like it started as one thing and ended as another thing by accident. Yeah. Like, it was a purposeful shift.
Yeah, I mean, you know, shocking that I would bring up Fruits Basket as a comparison, I know. For, I guess, a similar vibe in what we're talking about here with, like, their evolution could be found there, where it's, like, it's very clear that, like, the story in its full trajectory had been decided from the beginning, but in terms of just polish in both the art and the paneling and the writing, it gets better and improves as the creator gets more confidence and gains more experience going on. But, like, it's not like there's a huge, oh my god, I suddenly figured out what I'm doing with this series. It's a very solid series all around. I think it's definitely worth reading, not just as, you know, a fan of Kamatani, but just as a fan of manga. Especially shonen manga. This is this was a G Fantasy series. I think if you like things from that magazine or like Gon Gon Joker, this fits very well into their catalog, so you'd probably get a kick out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think it fits very well with those sorts of titles, whether it be like Vanitas or Pandora Hearts or even hell, Black Butler, wherein, like, it hooks you with one thing, and it starts as one thing, and I can also see why a lot of people had, perhaps, impression of this series going in, that was not quite what the series turned out to be, but I think we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But I do think it's one that, although it is quite hard to get now, I think it's very out of print. Well, I know it's very out of print from Yen, and I don't think there was a digital release. But if you are...
There's not.
Yeah, there's not. So if you are wanting to try it yourself, your best bet is probably a library or to hunt down secondhand volumes. And they do pop up from time to time. It's not like a total lost cause, especially because the series isn't hugely popular. I don't know how much demand there is for Nobari no O in the secondhand market, sadly.
But come on, Yen, you could put it up digitally.
They could. But I think I'll just give a little, for those who haven't seen, read, or watched, there's also an anime adaptation of the series. Nobara no O is the story of a middle school student called Miharu, who's just kind of happy to meander through life. He's quite indifferent to his surroundings. He comes from this really small, sleepy village called Banten. But he keeps being harassed by one of his teachers and one of his classmates to join, like, the ninja club. And he's just like, no, guys, I'm not interested.
Oh my god, cringe!
You guys, what? Ew!
He's
And these
Miharu
two...
is, like, he's apathetic in, like, the memer child sense.
In
like
a 14-year-old, yeah, memer boy way. But, so, he's kind of just living his life, but one day he gets kind of attacked by this group of ninjas who say they're from the Grey Wolves of the Iga clan, right in the middle of the day. And and he is saved by these two, the teacher and this classmate, and he discovers that in his body he houses this ultimate power that all of these kind of warring ninja clans want, the Shinra Bansho, so which would give him the power to be the king of the whole hidden world, all of this ninja society. And he's like, no thank you, don't like that, can we get rid of that.
Get it out of my body, please. I have math class.
I couldn't care less about all this ninja shit. I really don't want this power. And they're like, all right, well, actually, no, we want to protect you because you're in danger, obviously. You saw those ninjas try to attack us just like 2 minutes ago. So we're going to teach you ninja skills, but also we don't want you using that power because it's too much. Anyway, they have like a couple skirmishes. They meet another, a girl who comes to their class called Raime, who is a samurai. She's from one of the other ninja clans, and she invites them to her place, and there. That village has been attacked by these Grey Wolf ninjas, and that is where Miharu kind of meets our second protagonist, our secondary main character, Yoite, who is he's part of this Grey Wolves group. He has this horrific power called Kira, which uses life energy to kill people, basically, and things mm-hmm. just kind of go from there, and it's a wild ride. There's lots of politics going on, there's lots of, honestly, like, for as much as the series is about ninjas, they don't really focus on, like, all the ninja shit too much. They're fighting, but
not really.
They're not, like, doing all weird ninjutsu.
Yeah.
They're just...
They do, like, the Naruto weird hand signals every once in a while. But, like, to be honest, you know, a job that can be done with a gun will be done with a gun in this series.
Which I can appreciate. Like, right? This is a quote-unquote modern-day setting. And people have guns. Technically, but people have cell phones. People have, like, the internet.
Computers.
It's 2008.
Hacksaw skills.
It's 2008. Yeah. They're not, like, I don't know, just not using what's available, current technology. And as Ray said, if you can just shoot a guy or stab him, you don't need to do all weird ninja magic tricks to win the thing.
The main ninja magic is we've got sort of a collect-em-all plot going on that gets introduced pretty early, so I wouldn't consider it a spoiler. Mm-hmm. But basically, Miharu comes across the the devastating truth that it's not as simple as just taking the Shinra Bansho out of his body. But Tobari, the teacher, and Koichi and Raimei are all like, you know what? We'll figure out how to get it out of you if we can get all the other hidden art scrolls from each of the villages. They all have one. If we get them all, maybe we can figure out how to remove it safely from your body. Actually, the one who suggests this is the leader of the Fuma clan, which is Raimei's clan, and annoying. He's annoying. He's annoying. He's a key figure, shall we say. Mm-hmm. But he's also, like, a big nerd, so he's got a big fancy library, so he's like, if you collect all of these scrolls, then I'm sure we'll find something to get this thing out of your body. And Mihari's like, well, I don't have any better ideas, so...
Alright, we'll try that.
And that's the basic frame. We also have some stuff going on with Yoite. Miharu, shall we say, ends up developing quite a curious relationship with Yoite from very early on.
Mm-hmm.
Yoite has their own goals, which are not necessarily related to the Grey Wolves or to the Shinra Bansho. And Miharu, being as apathetic as he is to this whole ninja thing, is in a unique position to hear them out, I would say.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's, like, a million side stories with Raimei and her situation, Koichi and his situation, Tobari and his situation. Everyone's got shit going on.
Yeah, Yoite's ninja dad.
Yukimi, yeah.
Yeah, I love him.
He's good.
Precious bean. But, the family cat also...
She's got shit going on. There's this...
She's got shit going on. It's a lot. Honestly, I think that the main way that ninja manifest in this, as opposed to in Naruto, where they're, like, superheroes, basically, or wizards, basically. In Navari no O, they're, like, actual ninja in that they're mostly involved in, like, assassination, surveillance, sabotage, hacking as well. So that's, like, the main... ways that we see them.
Well, I thought you were gonna say, unlike Naruto, where their ninja powers are like magic, in Nobara no Oh, their ninja powers are like generational trauma. So
well, we'll get into the themes of the series, G. But just in terms of purely a plot thing, like, part of the reason that it gets so convoluted so fast is that, like, everyone's triple, quadruple agenting each other because they're all ninjas, mm-hmm. right? They're assassins and thieves by trade.
Mm-hmm.
Spies.
There's, honestly, it's a question of, like, how they've survived to the modern day with this much scheming going on. How they didn't all kill each other, like, 200 years ago is a big question.
Yeah. I feel like it's mostly the scheming of one man that keeps this whole thing alive.
Yes. I mean, yes.
And the Shinra Bansho getting awakened every 10 years to, like, you know, train everyone's focus not on each other. Mm. Anyway, should we get into some questions, maybe? Or did you want to talk about, your introduction to the series?
So I think that actually leads into one of the questions really well. So the first question from Flamwenko Girl, or at Flamwenko Girl, asked, did you read this before or after Kamatani's other manga? Did your reading order affect your experience with it? And if so, how? Yes, I did. And obviously, Ray has. But yes, I did read this after having read Our Dreams at Dusk. And I had knowledge of it. Again, like, I was aware of it. Similarly to you, Ray, I had, you know, various Funimation DVDs that had the the trailer for the anime that would play before whatever I was actually watching would start. And so I was aware of it. But oh my god, first of all, that anime trailer is so... it does not do a good job at representing what that series is.
It's just
is.
Like Naruto.
Well, yeah, it was, there were so many, like, you know, comedy bits. Like, it was just, the narrator uses so much, like, he's just not even interested. And, like, there is comedy, especially in the early parts of the series. Miharu, his indifference is played, and also his, like, manipulation of how other people see him is played for laughs quite consistently. But it's not Naruto. Like, it's not a comedy series, and if you're going into it for a comedy, I think you're going to be quite disappointed when it gets into, like, some existentially sad drama pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And gay shit.
Exactly. And then, so I was aware of it.
I do feel like I do feel like that trailer is something that Miharu would have pinned on all of his social media profiles, ironically.
I mean, you're probably not wrong. But I just always remember that they use, like, that gag of him dodging the pencils that Raime, like, chucks at him, and he doesn't notice, and then he turns, and everyone around him is, like, freaking out because he, like, dodged these pencils, and he, like, has this really delayed reaction. He's like, whoa! And, that was in the trailer. I remember that.
Oh. It's, like, anyway. etched into the very fabric of your brain.
Yes, I've never forgotten that.
Keep going.
But anyway, so after having read Our Dreams at Dusk and becoming a bit more familiar with Kamatani's work, like Ray and like, I, well, maybe it's unusual, but, like, obviously if I enjoy a creator's work, I do seek out their other titles. It's not always going to be a good experience because, you know, sometimes earlier works or other titles are, you know, not as good as the one that I'm a fan of, but sometimes I discover stuff that is very, very good. And at the time, Nobara no O was the only other Kamatani title available in English. Again, I was aware of it. I knew that it had been released by Yen. I knew that it, you know, had kind of this small but passionate fan base. And so I was like, well, I do like this creator. I'll try it. And really, I enjoy it, love it a lot. And then I also followed up with watching the anime, finally. And it was not what Funimation advertised it as. It's quite a close adaptation, actually, up until about... it has its own original ending, which is obviously different from the manga because it was, the anime came out whilst the manga was still being published. I think the anime was announced with the 8th or 9th volume, so there's still, you know, roughly half of the series to go. But thematically, I don't think it changed a lot, and it the ending was different. It's still, maybe, it will still make you cry. It's not a happy end. Well, both, the manga has a quote-unquote happy ending. I do think it's a happy ending. But not in a conventional sense. Mm-hmm. And I think that the anime also has that. It has a bittersweetly happy ending. So I think in that regard, it did it fairly well. A lot of the kind of larger plot villain arcs and stuff that were a bit more fleshed out or were more covered, and, you know, some of the later mysteries that were in the manga obviously were cut, but a lot of the core of the series is still in the anime. So they're not... Mm-hmm. It's an adaptation, it's not one-to-one, and I don't think this is a series popular enough to get a new adaptation down the line. But if you are a fan of either the manga and never watched the anime, it is worth at least a look. And if you've watched the anime and never read the manga, then I highly encourage you to do so. And as for reading order affecting my experience, I think knowing that it was an earlier work, I had my expectations more subdued than I would have otherwise. Especially with like a debut work, there's always going to be kind of a rough start. There's always going to be stuff that a creator learns over the course of a series, hopefully, fingers crossed. But so I wasn't, you know, holding it to the absolutely stellar expectations that I had for, or that I had had or and experienced with Our Dreams at Dusk. Especially because, again, it's like a very different premise, very more involved setting as well, with, you know, ninja and all this lore and all this stuff going on. Mm-hmm. 20 times the amount of characters, 3 times the length. But I think having read it after knowing what Kamatani has done now, and how their current titles have been written and released, I think it made me take notice of when their more familiar style of artistic flair, of that show don't tell type of story, was really starting to blossom, and when they started to really... Being familiar with their work helped me twig on, I think, a little bit earlier to some of the themes that were being presented within, like, the second, third, fourth volume. I think it definitely helped that I was already a Kamatani fan, but I do think that this is a title that stands on its own, and I don't think that, you know, you need to be a pre-existing fan to read it or to enjoy it either as well. What about yourself, Ray? How do you think your reading order has affected your experience?
I agree with everything that you said. First of all, I think that all applies to me as well. Especially, like, cottoning onto the themes that they were, you know, dealing with very early on. But also, like, I would say, in addition, like, knowing the creator means that I know things about them that, like, I wouldn't have going into Nobari no Ao. So, obviously, knowing that their claim to fame in the English-speaking world right now is an LGBTQ series, and knowing that they are ex-gender and asexual, that they're, you know, very outspoken about it. They, you know, do Pride every year. I think made it definitely affected, like, the context through which I read relationships, especially the core relationship between Miharu and Yoite, which is one of the fundamental cores of the series. I mean, I don't think, like, reading this series in the year of our Lord 2022, anyone's gonna walk away from it thinking that those two are, like, you know, just the best of buds. Nothing else.
They're just guys being pals, right? I don't know what you're talking about.
As well as, you know, the stuff with, like, Yoite's, gender, and sex.
Mm-hmm.
And then as well as, like, a detail that is, like, I think pretty individual to me as a person is that, you see, me and, Mix Kamatani have something very important in common, which is a mutual love and appreciation for the grand dame, Ms. Motohagio, one of their biggest and earliest influences, and boy does it show in everything they've ever drawn and mm-hmm. written ever, and I was absolutely picking up that influence beginning to end. I was so happy. I was living. I was thriving in my lane, moisturized, happy, relaxed. Ugh. Beautiful. Moi. Chef's kiss.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. And I absolutely agree, especially with your point of knowing Kamatani as this very prominent queer creator who is well established in the English market as, like, having written this kind of cornerstone or superstar title of LGBT manga. It's sort of the standard, the exceedingly high standard that a lot of other LGBT mangas held against.
Rightfully so.
Yeah, exactly, as it should be. But it does allow a reader or an audience who is more familiar with their work to see, and also just not to be kind of disheartened with, like, oh, this is just gonna be queer baiting me, like a lot of G fantasy series
do. Me sending pages of my favorite samurai boyfriends to G throughout reading the series.
And not only sending them to me for appreciation, but also to check that they kept it gay in the English, which they did. So, yes. You know, it has been maintained through Yen's publication. They didn't sanitize anything to be more
fantastic,
palatable for 2013 readers.
Ugh. And boy, we'll talk about those readers.
With that, I think that kind of covered all of that aspect of that question. The second of Flamenco Girl's questions is, any favorite or underrated moments? I know my favorite moment. What's your favorite moment?
Favorite moments. I have a lot. You can go first.
Well, the one... I have a lot as well, but the one that always jumps out in my mind that I just always catches my heart and takes my breath away is when Miharu and Yoite are on the train looking at the scenery passing by, or the night sky passing by. And it's so evocative of Night on the Galactic Railroad. And I just, I cry every time. I know it's coming, and I just weep.
Mm-hmm.
And because that, for those familiar with that short story, is very emblematic of all sorts of things going on as well. I love it. Mm. The other one is when Yoite and Miharu have escaped and they've run and they end up, like, in a warehouse. Miharu doesn't have shoes And so Yoite goes
to
get, like, band-aids and medicine. And he washes and fixes his feet. And that's just, like, such a small little moment of intimacy and caring and for these characters who, they try to be indifferent or pretend like they don't care about anything or have been so focused on not wanting to make connections that this small little moment of real just vulnerability with each other. I mean, and their whole relationship is vulnerability for the most part, but that just, the whole, like, volume 8, 9, 10 of the series rips me apart. I think
their entire, like, date sequence in volume 10 is, like, important to me.
Yes. And then also my other favorite moment that isn't completely focused on our two boyfriends, is when Miharu is, when they're talking to, or when she's, they go out to kind of do the spotlight on Hanabusa, who is, Tobari's, like, partner, girlfriend partner. And she is a paleontologist, and she's talking about how all life, how paleontology is, like, such a, it seems like such a useless science because you're just looking at things that have been dead for hundreds of millions of years. But she talks about how all life being connected and, like, how these ancient plants and insects and animals all flow through their lives, brought forth more lives, which brought forth more lives, which tie to ours, and then when we're gone, we just become this big, like, chain of life. And so every life is important regardless of, like, your place in the world. And it's just so beautifully done. Also, I have a big bias because as an earth science major, I will always just be there for any kind of geology or paleo, anything. I will take anything, and Hanabusa's amazing. I love her. And, that was just such a fantastic moment that also, again, tied in just the whole theme of, like, why you are important and why your life is important, even if you don't feel important.
I was going to talk about that scene as well. And, like, honestly, that whole subplot I love with Yukimi taking Miharu around as a photography assistant. Because it's, like, obviously, you know, he has a reason to, because he is short an arm, which makes it difficult to take pictures. But obviously he's doing this because, like, Miharu's down and he wants to make Miharu feel better. because he is a soft, soft man. Mm-hmm. But I loved that whole sequence. For all the reasons that you said, of course, but also, like, the way that it, to put in context, since I think it's okay to just spoil the whole series now, because this is our podcast and this is how we run it, but, Yoite, of course, is no longer with us at this point in the series. And Miharu has used the Shinra Bansho to, make all memory of Yoite disappear. So nobody remembers Yoite, but they all have this sort of itch in the back of their brains that there's something, someone that they're not remembering. And that's so much worse than the grief of remembering.
Mm-hmm.
But, so that ties into what Hanabusa is saying here, because she's talking about how each of these fossils in the earth is a memory of past life. So we get it tied into, like you were saying, overarching themes about the importance of memory, the importance of going through those stages of grief instead of running from them, and what it means to disappear.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a very conceptual angle of Kamatani being interested in what it would look like if a person disappeared all of a sudden, and exploring what that would look like. But, and I also enjoyed this because, as I said on Twitter, the extended science metaphor is just a very Hagio thing to do. So, I enjoyed that. It's a lot of extended earth science metaphors and marginal as well.
Mm-hmm.
And Otherworld Barbara. And then other favorite sequences. Actually, right after the aftermath of the Shinraban show being used.
Mm-hmm.
When everything's still hazy and we don't know what's happened. When Miharu wakes up in a cabin in the woods. And Koichi is a child all of a sudden. He's like, I don't know, first you were my lame classmate in the ninja club, and then you were a brutal murderer, and then you were a bird, and now you're 9.
And soon you'll be 35.
35. and then back to normal. But, but I don't know, it's just this quiet moment of peace, I think, in a time in the series that was very, you don't know who to trust, mm-hmm. everyone's turning on everyone, there's, like, so much violence, everyone keeps getting shot, Yoite just died.
Mm-hmm.
But also you have this undercurrent of unease, where mm-hmm. it's like people keep referencing things that are happening, but they seem to be trying to keep it from Miharu.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just something that Miharu knows he's forgetting.
Mm-hmm. That reminds me...
But he doesn't know what.
Yeah, that reminds me of another favorite moment from kind of that period of the manga, is where Yukimi, his arm starts getting phantom pain, and...
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And that being, like, actually physically representative of, they all know that they've forgotten something very, very important to them, and it's not there, but they can still feel the hurt from it, and they mm-hmm. still know that something's missing.
Mm-hmm.
and it's that question of, like, if it's missing, if I know that it's not there, or if it isn't there, why do I still feel this way, and why am I still having this reaction to something that I don't remember or can't physically see. And I thought that was just a really powerful moment between these two characters who are really the mentor characters, Yukimi and Tobare, where they have that, they don't really like each other. They've been on opposite mm-hmm. sides
no.
for so long. But in that moment, they both, like, recognize that the world has changed in a way that they don't understand, and that they can't adjust to something that they haven't had, like, they don't have any information on, right? And again, it's this, like, metaphor for grieving, which you see carry on mm-hmm. throughout, like, that whole last 4 volumes. Yeah.
I also, I really like that sequence as well, just because we get a very human moment of weakness from Yukimi there, where, like, he's like, you know, this isn't Miharu's fault, and Miharu's a fucking kid, but, like, honestly, fuck him. I'm so angry. Why does it hurt so much? Why is there something that I'm forgetting? Why did he make me forget? This is a violation of my autonomy. Which, you know, he's, like, the adult mentor figure in the series, so it's not necessarily the kind of emotion you would expect that type of character to express in a shonen series, but it is very human. You know, speaking of the adult characters expressing very human weakness, obviously, the entire series, we have this huge grand build-up to Tobari revealing what happened 10 years ago, because he's the only person in the world who remembers, because it was another case of the Shinribansho eliminating people's memories on a wide scale. Just, like, I don't know, that moment where it's like he finishes telling everything that he has to say, and then he just breaks down crying in front of this kid. It's just like, I'll start crying right now, you know?
Well, I also think that although this is Miharu and Yoite's story, it's also Tobaru's story. Like, it, there's so much of this story hinges on him, and him... having this horrible trauma of the past and being solely responsible for that information since he was like 16. He was dumped with this like so young, because this being 16 is so young, and he's had to live with this for almost half his life, and it's not something he can share with anyone either. So I think there, for me, there's like such palpable relief for him when he does have that breakdown after sharing, you know, this large secret of what's happened, of him finally being free from this thing that's haunted him for a decade. It's just
I love how that's followed up immediately by him, like, you know, this whole time he's been preparing the hidden art scroll for Banten, which is, like, this whole lead-up, because it's like, we knew from the beginning that he was hiding it somewhere, but that it was only available through oral history. And, you know, at the very end, he just takes the cuff off his ear and prepares it in water, I don't know, ninja magic, and then when it's ready, he, like, he shows it after this huge, like, you know, breakdown, after, like, showing all this horrible stuff that he's been shouldering. He shows what's on the Banten scroll, and it's, like, because this is, like, you know, an ancient scroll from ancient ninja, you know, something that they would have considered very fearsome and magical. It's just, like, a little magical video camera that has just, like, one little clip on it of baby Miharu and his parents, and it's the first time, because Miharu's had all of his memories from 10 years ago wiped, so it's his first time ever seeing his parents. And Tobari's, like, first time looking at this since that stuff all happened. And it's just, like, this beautiful, like, you have the moment of relief from him finally being able to just sit down and cry after telling all of this, but then you also have, like, the beautiful catharsis of, like, you know, and here's this one beautiful memory to come out of this that I can share with all of you.
And it's also so powerful that it is... It's simple. It's just, like, a little home clip of them, like, oh, like, let's look at the thing. Like, there's no special information shared in this little clip. It truly...
But somehow it's, like, it's the most important of, like, any of the hidden scrolls that we've seen up to this point. It's so much more powerful than the power to read minds or the power to
cure all change your wounds. Form.
Cure all wounds by using, you know, children sauce.
There's yeah, it's it's a good series, guys. Like, I don't know if we're coming across with that, but like, even early on, there's some really powerful little quiet moments. And then also there's just some, like, funny stuff as well. Like when Yoite is, like, stuck in the little alley between two buildings. And Miharu walks by and is like, Miharu, oh, hey.
Just goes and hide with them.
And then he, like, crawls in there with him as well. And they're just, like, chatting in this little...
This doesn't help anything. Yeah. Yoite is such a funny character because it's, like, they're trying so hard to be so badass, but, like... They are the softest child.
Mm-hmm.
And they're such an airhead, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Aww.
And then Miharu is just, like, a meme lord, so this is all very funny.
A meme lord who thinks he doesn't care, but he actually does care a whole lot.
He actually cares too much. Yeah.
So much.
Yeah, also, I was talking with G before the podcast, but the fact that Koichi is just, like, canonically really bad at his transformation jutsu and just, like, keeps randomly shifting ages. And then, like, he's just, like, there's a whole chapter where he's just, like, a 35-year-old man, and I kept having to look back and see, like, because I was like, is this on purpose? But then, like, Raime smacks him in the head or something, and he turns back into a teenager. It's like, you fixed it!
Yay!
Owls, fun fact, some of the dumbest birds in the bird world.
That tracks.
Relevant? You decide.
So, I mean, there's so many, like, fantastic moments throughout the course of the series, but I think a good follow-up is Flum Wenko Girls's third and final question. Did you make any predictions for the characters or ending when reading? If so, did they come true or not? I know for me it was somewhat
okay.
Yep, I know. I was gonna say it was inevitable for me, knowing that Yoite wasn't gonna make it to the end. It didn't feel like that was happening, and as you go through, it wasn't going to end on, like, a happy note regarding that. I think that mm-hmm. was pretty cut and dry for me from the very beginning. And I know you, Ray, had some pretty accurate predictions.
Yeah, well, I had a big one that wasn't accurate, and another big one that was.
Mm.
I mean, I figured from very early on, because I was like, the politician guy is, first of all, he's too obvious. Mm-hmm. And second of all, he's too passionate.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in this series, it's a good thing to be passionate about something, even if, like, what he's passionate about is fucking unhinged.
Mm-hmm.
And even if he's this horrible abusive figure to Yoite, he's the one who coerced Yoite into learning Kira in the first place. He's very much a cult leader. But I was like, okay, it's not gonna be him because, like, he's here for a purpose. He wants something.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, it's gonna be Fuma because it's like he's... From the very beginning, he's been like, yeah, by the way, don't trust me. But then he keeps showing up. And, yeah, lo and behold, he was the bad guy in the end. Whoops. I did not guess that he was a Kira user as well, but that did not shock me either.
Mm-hmm. I mean, knowing that guy, but, he was dabbling in everything, so...
Yeah,
the fact
I don't
that...
know why I didn't predict that. It's just something that didn't cross my mind.
Mm.
But, yeah, It makes sense, though, because he's using transformation jutsu all the time, so he's just using it to cover up the fact that he looks ratchet.
That his body is absolutely atrophying everywhere, in every sense of the word.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that's what happens when you use Kira, is it sucks away your own life energy, which is something that Yoide knows well. But the thing that I was wrong about was the ending. Because I definitely thought that, like, the series was building up this idea of the world of Nabari itself as, like, an extended metaphor for generational trauma. Mm-hmm. And I thought that the ending might be that Miharu uses the Shinra Bansho to just eliminate the world of Nabari altogether.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't, so I was wrong about that. I mean, the hidden arts are definitely, like, a metaphor for generational trauma, but it's also just lore, so I guess Kamatani just didn't feel like going that deep into the world of metaphor.
I think also, like, by the end of it, the hidden world, the ninja world, you know, is in enough of a shambles that, like, for most, like, there are certainly large players still happening, but the biggest ones, I think, are either dead or, like, enough of pacifists that they're not gonna start a more shit anytime soon. So.
Yeah. Government's still up to shit, because they're always up to shit, but with Fuma gone, a lot of things are, like, that just eliminates a lot of Nabari to begin with.
Yeah. I mean, Fuma's gone, Hattori's gone, so, like, there's a lot of leadership empty now, and I don't think the, the assistant, she's not a frontline player, she's the manipulator behind the scenes, right? So, like...
She'll just find some other charismatic leader to latch onto.
Yeah, exactly. So, with that, I think we'll jump to Marumichi's comments, or questions, because they have so many. Their first was, what makes Nabara no O special to you and different from other shonen manga? Its fandom is small, but it has a special place in its devoted fans' hearts. As we mentioned a little bit before, this is from G-Fantasy. Their kind of catalog is a little bit outside of the more typical shonen fare. It does appeal more to female fans, especially. But I think what makes Nabari special to you, or to me, even compared to something like Pandora Hearts or Black Butler or, you know, any of the other various G Fantasy series that I've read over the many years, is the earnestness in how it captures or portrays a lot of its characters, in how it explores a lot of these very serious themes of generational trauma, of like acceptance and community and fighting for something, and, you know, stuff that we have become more familiar with, this almost detached protagonist or character finding purpose or discovering themselves through other people. Again, the importance of community, which is something we see happen or repeated in Our Dreams at Dusk, in Hiraeth as well. I haven't read Shonen Note, but I'm sure there's certainly themes of that there too. And so I feel like what makes it special is that not only does it have a lot of elements that already make a story very strong, very likable characters, a compelling story or plot, maybe for some, and maybe not for others, but, you know, a political drama with some action, with some, sometimes some cool, like, fight stuff happening. That's already, like, pretty well-established. Maybe to Nobari's detriment a little bit, again, because if you came into it expecting Naruto, you're not going to get Naruto. But actually, comparatively, if we were to... I really like a lot of early Naruto stuff because of the drama, because of the emotional weight of some of those characters and, like, their experiences. Chapter 1 of Naruto is, like, really solid. It has some, you know, some jokes that I don't think hold up very well. But, like, yeah, I do think that Naruto, like, his sense of isolation and, like, always looking for acceptance and, you know, what, like, the whole thing, I think there's some really powerful themes that was why that series was so beloved, because people loved caring about characters, right? Like, hopefully you care about the characters you're reading about. And I think Nobari has so many characters that you care about, even though they're extremely nuanced, you know, that things, they have done bad things have been done to them, they are a product of their environment or their upbringing, but they're all in their own way, aside from some of the villains. But even the villains, they're dedicated in what they want to do, they think they're in the right, or they're completely passionate about that, but all of the characters are just trying their hardest to make the right decision and to try not to mess up any more than has already been messed up. And in that way, it kind of reminds me of Chainsaw Man, to be perfectly honest with you. So,
yeah,
I mean, that, I think that with any, like, any series of Nobari's side, like, so what am I gonna say, fandoms of small sizes like Nobari's, they exist because the extremely passionate fans are still there, and it is a testament to a story that doesn't have to be a smash hit to have enduring fans for more than a decade. Because I do still see people, like, post art or reflect on the series and have very fond memories of it, or, you know, are creating content for it on a semi-regular basis. And that, I think, is just, yeah, testament to how powerfully affected a story like Nobari's that has such a nuanced look at grief, at again, these cycles of trauma and pain and overcoming that, the things in your life to do better is really important. And I think that's why people still talk, or at least look back on it now as very earnest and worth remembering. If that does that make sense? Worth remembering, especially now, that hopefully more people are being introduced to Kamitani's work through their more recent stuff, because, you know, it does deserve to be read and to be enjoyed and to be cried over, right?
Yeah, in a similar boat, I think something that I found very memorable about the series that I definitely think is also true of Kamitani's other works that I've read, but, especially here where everyone to some extent is a murderer and a spy, instead of, you know, in a middle school choir club, or renovating old houses for fun, is just how honest Kamitani is about what can be the negative sides of humanity, when it comes to just being confused and chaotic and lashing out in hurt. The impulse to try to, in trying to get control of your own situation, to try to dominate other people, the impulse to lash out and hurt people because you've been hurt.
Mm-hmm.
They're so honest about these things, but at the end of the day, they are also so honest about and earnest about rejoicing in the beauty of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what is important about people and relationships when they're going well, when there's love, and when there's empathy, and when there's a genuine desire for connection, and a genuine desire to help someone else. Because that's ultimately what starts to bring Miharu out of his shell, is that he finds someone that he wants to help from his own, from himself. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not even necessarily a good idea if he talks to anyone around him. But he's met this person, and he thinks that they deserve his help. And he realizes that he wants to help them. And that, you know, basically kicks off his entire arc. And of course, he develops a much deeper relationship with Yoite from then, but it starts from a very genuine desire to help someone other than himself.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think, again, to that point, the fact that they acknowledge that grief and going through a grieving process when things are tough, or, you know, when life is hard and things are bad, is just as important as remembering, like, the good times. And it's an important part of life to be able to grieve for people or places or things that are no longer in your life. And it's
also, you know, just like the fossils that are, you know, left in the rock after millions of years, that mm-hmm. just because someone has died doesn't mean that they're gone.
Mm-hmm.
Because most of us can't erase memories with our magic lady living inside us. So.
And also that point of, like, even if you or someone you love is gone, you know, that for that person, they don't see everyone that's affected by that afterwards. Like, if you are in the position where you feel like nobody cares about you, or you don't have a place in the world, or there's no one who loves or cares for you, it can be very hard, you know, after the fact. And you see this a lot with people who survive suicide attempts, finally seeing, like, how many people are extremely worried or hope, like, care about them, that would be extremely affected if they died. It's something that I think, especially for, like, kids who might see themselves in, like, Miharu's position of, like, being very unaffected or, like, dissociated from a lot of their community and life, and they don't have very many friends. And not that Miharu is, like, in a bad position. You know, he has a grandmother who loves him. He has, you know, people who want to be his friends. He lives a relatively safe life, but he doesn't have those connections. And of course, with Yoite as well, like, they'd had no even perception that anybody cared about them. And then we see, obviously, mm-hmm. not just the people who in the recent years have known and been influenced by Yoite, but Yoite's brother or close mm-hmm. to brother, right? Like, there's a relationship there that that he has always wanted to find mm-hmm. what happened to Yoite.
I really liked Yoite's character progression as well. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's a very high emotion arc, as you know, they live a very dramatic life, but just the progression from, you know, obviously wanting to disappear at the start, mm-hmm. wanting to have never existed in the first place, which is what they ask Miharu for help with, to, like, being in basically the closest they've ever come to death,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, gasping out, you know, I don't want to die. But then going after that, you know, past the point of not wanting to die to realizing that they're happy to be alive,
mm-hmm.
I think it was a very... I mean, I cried a lot throughout.
mm-hmm.
But I thought that that progression was very important, because I think that... certainly I've never been through the depths of despair that Yoite has been through. But, as someone who's, you know, at the very least been through, you know, some very deep depression, in my life, I think that that's the mark of, like, honesty in this type of story for me, is, like, whether you have that step in the middle where the character realizes that they don't actually want to die.
Mm-hmm.
Dying is scary. Before they realize, like, it's another step further to mm-hmm. realize that you want to be alive.
Mm-hmm.
Not wanting to die and wanting to be alive are two different things.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them can be a lot easier to get to than the other. So I appreciated that, I think. If that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely, it does. And I agree 100%. On a lighter note, I think, Marumichi's next question is, favorite character?
Ugh, it's hard. I have a few.
Mm-hmm. why does that not surprise Yoite, me?
Obviously.
Yeah.
Hey, it doesn't surprise you because you also have a few, I'm sure.
Yes.
Yoite. I do love my samurai boys, Raiko and Gao.
Hmm.
Gao is truly the goodest boy.
Mm-hmm.
Just so soft. And then I love Bird Boy, Koichi.
Even if you great. Do want to smack He's him around a bit. He's kind
of
the punching bag
of the series. I want to smack him around sometimes. But he's just as confused as everyone else. He just thinks that he knows what's happening because he's 300 years old. But he is one of the dumbest birds in the animal kingdom.
Mm.
And he would do good to remember it. Has no idea what he's talking about sometimes. I liked his little thing with Raimei. In typical Kamatani fashion, this is not a relationship you can tie up as, like, romantic, like, strictly a romantic relationship or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But they're very sweet. I'm glad Koichi was able to find oneness with the universe or whatever. and I also love Yukimi a lot. He was the character, it's like every time he showed up after a while, I was like, yes, Yukimi!
Yeah. Like, because he shows up in the first...
Dad's back!
he shows up in the first volume as just, like, kind of a generic bad guy with a gun.
Bad guy with a gun.
And he very quickly becomes, like...
he doesn't... Yeah, his first interactions with Yoite is, like, very, like, scoffing at Yoite and how annoying they are. But then, like, the second interaction we see between him and Yoite, is, I think, the one where he's, like, you know, like, I don't mind if you disappear for a few days, but, like, you know, you can always come back here when you just, you know, need a place to crash or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, this character is gonna be a softy.
Well, he like reiterates the point that he doesn't like kids. Like, he's like, oh, I hate having these brats around. But he he loves taking in strays, and that's basically what he does, like, constantly. And if those strays just happen to be kids, then, you know.
You know what? Stray kids. Like the band. Ha ha.
Ha ha.
Yeah. He's great. He makes my heart grow 3 sizes
mm-hmm.
every time he appears.
Yes.
What? Who are your favorite characters, G?
I mean, aside from everyone you just mentioned, you know, Yoite, Mihara, just the whole main cast. I also really love Tobari. I think he's really... he's a powerful character in what he represents, and he's so focused on, like, what he, in shouldering everything and, like, taking on responsibility for everything because he's been put in that position. And
mm-hmm.
as you said, like, having that catharsis towards the end where he doesn't have to do that anymore is just really powerful, especially because he was, again, this, like, teenager who kind of got thrown in this whole situation because his grandpa knocked him out and got him on a plane somehow.
Yeah, oh my gosh, that's the most horrific thing you could do to a person.
I know.
Oh, and my he's god, like, he's stranded him on this island.
He's like, I'm never going back to Northern Ireland because I just hate vehicles. I guess I'm stuck here forever. And you're like, oh my god.
Yeah, he's stranded. Oh my god, just knowing, like, because, okay, my mom has a paralyzing fear of airplanes, and mm-hmm. like, that's why... even when my the rest of my family came and visited me in Japan, like, she was left behind because, mm-hmm. like, she cannot do 13 hours in an airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, with that context, I was like, this is the most abusive thing you could do to a person. What the hell?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This poor guy is just like, I just want to live my life. And everyone is just... Why?
Saddling me with their shit.
With all of their shit. I was just probably a somewhat normal teen in Northern Ireland, and then my grandpa, cop that he is, brought me to Japan for a skirmish that, like, I had nothing to do with. So, and I guess this is my life now.
My weird weeaboo grandfather who uses the word Japanimation because he's a boomer and he's a cop. His grandfather is portrayed positively by the narrative, by the way.
Yes, his grandfather's sucks. Not like a bad guy, but also he's kind of a bad guy. Like,
a bad person.
He put his grandson in a lot of stuff that he didn't need to be a part of.
He's a bad person.
Yes. But then I also wanted to say that, and we've spoken about her a lot already, but Hanabusa, who's Tobari's partner, girlfriend, however you want to qualify it. And I really think she's one of the most important characters because she's outside of all of this bullshit, like, outside of all of this ninja stuff. She has no relationship to that world, quote unquote, at all, but she still knows and sees and acknowledges all of these issues that are happening to people that she cares about, and taking them seriously, but also kind of grounding them, reminding them that, like, life isn't just bunch of clan wars and, like, secret arts and weird magic. And that the relationships between people are foundationally way more important. And you see that with how she mm-hmm. just unanimously accepts people and welcomes them into her home.
Yeah.
And so I love her. And again, I just think she's amazing because she's also a paleontologist. She's thriving at 40-something with a younger boyfriend. She's just living the life. Mm-hmm. And she does finger knitting as well. So that's cool.
Yeah. She reminds me of some of the teacher figures in Shonen Note or, like, Samwon-san in Our Dreams at Dusk. Sort of a impartial observer. She's certainly less impartial than, like, Samwon-san. Mm. But, like, serving that kind of role of someone who's completely outside this, this turmoil that the rest of the characters are in. Mm-hmm. And just being like, you know what? If you just need a place to, like, kick up your feet and have some tea and a good conversation, like, I'm here, you know? And I feel like there's always a character in every Kamatani series I've read who serves that function. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's really important.
Well, I think that's one... Another thing that just, like, makes their manga stand out is that they do have this, like, impartial outside observer, right? Not inherently impartial, but, like, this person who can see beyond the immediacy of the general plot or situation that isn't so hyper-focused on the goals or the issues that our main characters are, and provides perspective... Yeah. That I don't think you see a lot of, necessarily, in other manga, just generally. You don't often have those characters that are like, guys, chill out. You know, the world isn't actually going to end if you don't, if you just have a nap right now. Because in a lot of those series, the world will end if they take a nap right now. Yeah. But
I do like this overall, like, even though there's these various organizations in this manga, I really appreciate that, like, what Kamatani values here and what the characters end up realizing that is important to value is, like, their one-on-one relationships with each other rather than, you know, who they work for. So it's like, even if you have a character who's very zealous in their convictions and their particular allegiance to a group, like Raiko with the Grey Wolves, ultimately, like, his reckoning comes when he realizes that, you know, rather than some, like, grand, some other man's grand ambition for the world, like, he loves his sister, and he loves Gao, and he loves all these people that he's gotten to know, and he doesn't want to assassinate them, even if the person that he idolizes is ordering him to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that ends up being his reason for defection. And it's like, that's kind of the... Or like Tobari, having this constant contradiction between what he says is his overarching conviction and, like, the various things that cause him to waver in that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, overall, there's this emphasis on the importance of, like, figuring out how you feel about people one-on-one over the macro scale. Yeah.
Well, I think it's also, like, valuing people over valuing causes, because you can be as passionate as you want over any cause, you know, good, bad, or otherwise, but it's also, like, how you treat those people involved in that cause. Like, you can, in real life, you know, you could be as passionate about like immigration policy or, you know, LGBT rights or whatever. But if you're homophobic in your private life, or racist or whatever else, you're not actually like that's not good, right?
Yeah. And like that really comes up in like Our Dreams at Dusk as well, which is their LGBTQ series. It's like ultimately Our Dreams at Dusk is in a similar way sort of embracing the complexity of the human experience and embracing the gray areas and the feelings of I don't know, or I don't get it yet, or I'm not quite sure, like what label or whatever I should put on myself. I'm still figuring it out. Embracing ambiguity as an inherent part of the queer experience. And I think that you see that here as well, not necessarily with regard to queerness, but just in overall worldview, an embrace of complexity and of ambiguity and of contradiction, that this is all part of, like, figuring out where you stand. And that ultimately you have to value the human element over whatever organization you're a part of or whatever grand conviction you hold.
So, I think with that, we'll go to Marumuchi's next question. We've already talked about our favorite scenes and moments, but they also asked, would you like to see Kamatani return to Nobara no O's world and characters via spin-off manga, sequel manga, or short story collection? I will say that they kind of already did this. They wrote a doujin for Komita in 2011, 2013, like a while ago, whilst it's set kind of during the events of volume 11 and is Yukimi focused. It also has a appearance of a Shonen Note character because that was the series that they were writing at the time. But it's a little interlude that is just kind of additional, especially like very magical realism aspects to it. So they technically have returned, and I don't know if I would want them to do any more so than they have, just because the series itself kind of has this closing finality to it that makes it feel done, right? Like, I don't think there's any loose ends that needed to be tied up. We don't want a Boruto situation for this. Well, I don't know about you, Ray, but
only if Kamatani just comes out and makes every single character queer, all the one not just the ones who already are, but just every single one of them incredibly gay. I agree, but I also think that, like, I wouldn't mind maybe, like, a Hanabusa-focused story. Or, like, maybe a story focusing on one of her students, and then she's, like, a character. I think that'd be nice. I think that Kamatani likes fossils, so that would probably be fun. Yeah. Or we could follow Yoi the cat around.
I'm sure he gets up to lots of adventures, that little.
Kamatani should make, like, a cat manga that's just all of the cats in all of their series.
Honestly, that would be the first cat manga that I actually buy. I would, day one, pre-order that shit. It's the it, now is the time. Now the market's ready for it.
Yeah, we already got the Hagio Cat manga.
Yeah. If publishers can license like 7 different versions of Cats but Zombie Apocalypse, then they can like there's room for just a cat manga about all different sorts of cats from pre-existing series. It's fine. I will say in the doujin, there's like all the cats, so it's not like you're missing out on cats in that little include either.
They always find an excuse to include cats.
I wonder if they're a cat person, right?
I wonder. I think they're a cat bird person. They revealed that 2 of the characters in Navari no O are a cat and a bird, and I was like, yep.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yep.
That's correct. We love a self-indulgent creator, as we've said many times.
Yeah, absolutely. If you can't be true to yourself, then what can you be, really? So, Marumichi continues with more questions. We spoke a little bit about like how we discovered Nobara no O and why we became interested in it. But they also ask, what do you think is the reason why Nobara no O isn't very popular outside of its small fan base, aka what made people look down on it and pass on it? I mean,
this is where we bring up the discourse.
Yes.
The 2009-2010 discourse, which I do remember.
My favorite flavor of discourse. Late 2000s, early 2010s.
Yep. It's, anyway, a lot of it is, like, a timing thing.
Yeah.
As well as, like, a lot of weird marketing for both the anime and the manga. Really focusing on the fact that it's about ninjas.
Mm-hmm.
So people were like, oh, so it's a Naruto ripoff.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm sure it probably wouldn't exist without Naruto. Like,
mm-hmm.
just like, you know, a lot of series wouldn't exist without Evangelion, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they really have nothing at all in common, except the hand signals every once in a while show up.
Yeah, it's not like Naruto invented ninjas. Like, they did exist prior to that manga.
Well, but I mean...
Yeah, but a popularity of, like, a kind of manga about it. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But, anyway, so I remember the discourse being here that it was a Naruto ripoff, and that it was a gay series from the gay magazine for girls. So, you know,
mm-hmm.
late 2000s discourse.
Yeah, exactly. It was, as Ray said, like, the marketing was really odd on the English side, namely because I think they were also banking on people, like, making that association with other ninja series. Even if it wasn't Naruto, if it was something like any of the dime a dozen, like, rom-com kind of action series that were coming out.
Mm-hmm.
I can't even remember any of their names. That's kind of how forgettable they...
Ninja Nonsense.
Yeah, Ninja Nonsense. What's that? Kaze no Stigma? Was that one?
Oh yeah. Like, oh my goodness.
There was a lot of stuff that was like action, like
ninjas,
various clans fighting over some secret bullshit. With like comedy thrown in, right? Because these are all like, mm-hmm. yeah, they're just high school, middle school kind of fun action adventure series. And so it makes sense that the marketing for this series would be in line with that, but it vastly misrepresents what the series is, was, and has always been. And again, that's not to say that there isn't, like, especially in the first couple of volumes, it isn't to say that there's no comedy, it isn't to say that it's, like, just miserable the whole time, that it doesn't have these kind of action, ninja, warring clan tropes. It does. It certainly does. Mm-hmm. But, like, I wouldn't say that Kaze no Stigma has the same kind of emotional levity that Nobari no has. And it never tried to, right? Like, it never tried to. And, like, Shakugan no Shana is another one, which is very popular.
Oh my gosh.
All this stuff.
Stop. Stop.
Plus,
once you start,
yeah,
there's no end.
Yeah, exactly. Plus, as you said, there is this, like, overt homophobia against anything that could be perceived as, like, fujo bait or for girls or, you know, appealing to fujoshi, which of course this did and does. It's not
in- it's got literal gay characters in it.
Exactly. But and that's the thing, is like in 2010 it was still like a bad thing to be seen as a fujoshi. It was still bad to be regarded as like enjoying male characters maybe kissing, like the idea that they might kiss. It's, you know, there's this whole blatant homophobia within the wider anime manga community that obviously within like fandoms was less, but then you also within fandoms, I don't know about Nobari necessarily because I wasn't around within the fandom at that time. I'm sure they were very dedicated to their pairings. But you always, you always run into like certain fans who are like, no, you're just you're just perceiving this as gay. I don't know how that you're obviously just got your your gay goggles on. You're a fangirl who just is just delirious, just not comprehending this story at all. They're just guys being pals. How dare you assume that they aren't that? Which obviously is problematic. Again, I don't know if that was necessarily the case with Nobari, because it's pretty freaking blatant. But I also don't know if Kamatani was openly like out at the time either. So then there was also maybe the question of like queer baiting and all these other things, because, you know, that's how fandom works and media discourse works. And of course, as you're saying, like, timing-wise, it was against stuff like Naruto and Fullmetal Alchemist and, I don't know, Rurouni Kenshin and all these, like, well, maybe Rurouni Kenshin's a little bit earlier, but, like, some pretty solid, some, like, solid, action shonen titles. And this is a similar issue that another favorite of mine, Kakashi, had as well, where it, like, the super popular stuff got interest, and I'm sure there was people buying it and talking about it, but not nearly to the level of, like, a FMA or a Bleach or a Naruto. So it kind of got forgotten quite quickly. And then also, it kind of also timed pretty well with those, like, action shonen series that were more so, like, the fujo bait that did have very, like, very, very passionate fan bases and ended up with a lot of backlash because of that. Again, Black Butler, but even like D Gray Man, those sorts of titles that girls were like, oh my gosh, these boys are kissing, and then every like non-Fujo fan is like, how dare you even think that gay people exist? In my pure manga, Japan doesn't even know what gay people are. How dare you? And then you're like, all right.
Yeah. It's, and then, I think on top of that, like, compared to other, like, G-Fantasy series of the time, mm-hmm. like, the series is pretty low-key, both in terms of action.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of, it's much more deliberately paced than a lot of shonen action series of the
mm-hmm.
time.
Mm-hmm.
Or now. Yes. Like, just in general. It's very deliberately paced. And there's a lot of quiet moments where people are just talking or drinking tea or feeling feelings. And there's also, like, not a lot of, like, blatant flirting between the male cast for phrasing, but like for something like Black Butler or even like a Pandora Hearts, mm-hmm. it's like, you know, we're expecting a certain kind of banter
yes.
here that is not present. If anything, Miharu and Yoite to me come across as more queer platonic than anything.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes sense. yeah, you know, nobody's like, hey, cutie. Nice ass.
Yeah.
people are gonna be like, what did you think Black Butler was about? But don't even try to tell me that's not what Black Butler is like, because, girl.
Yeah. I mean, I like Black Butler, but, like, the fans aren't...
But it is trashy.
Yes, and the fans are not pulling shit, like, out of thin air. It supplies everything.
It is gleefully trashy.
Yes.
And I am saying this from my home in the garbage, so, like, that's what we love about it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And also, to that point of, like, it has a lot of quiet moments, it's very deliberately paced, the action isn't very, like, bombastic either. Like, as we mentioned, if a fight will end with someone getting shot, they'll get shot, right? Like, there's no power-ups, there's no, like, leveling bullshit going on, there's no, like, crazy...
There's not even, like, different kinds of guns. Like, everyone just uses pistols.
Which...
Everyone just whips out a handgun, and that's it. There's not even, like, sniper rifles.
Which makes sense, because, like, where are these guys gonna get sniper rifles? They're not... I'm surprised they have handguns.
They're not in America.
Exactly. And also... So it's not bombastic with its action. It's also not, like, that over-the-top with its weird supernatural bullshit, either. Like, it has element... Like, it has, you know, immortal beings, and it has, you know, this kind of crazy powers. But we don't have a lot of, like, monsters from other worlds, or, like, this inhuman force we're fighting against... Or, like, all of these characters who, again, just, like, get amazing powers because of some supernatural bullshit. There's, like, 3-4 characters who have some weird bullshit going on. And then the rest of the cast is just normal people with guns. And it's, like, yeah. Or a sword, right? Like, it's...
Who can do a bit of karate.
Yeah. They're, it's not, like, Miharu is... does stand out because he has this, like, this weird mystical bullshit amazing lost art within him, and that's weird,
but he can't do anything
there, and he can't do anything. But also, that's why people want him, you know. If everyone had crazy powers, they wouldn't give a shit as much, right?
He can change the very fabric of reality, so
but that's exactly the point. Like, he has the almost, like, the most crazy, amazing power of anything you could ever do. But, like, there's probably a reason that up until this point, the ninja world hasn't been that focused on getting the other secret arts outside of the Shin Bansho. Like, it would be helpful if you could read people's minds, but also, like, that doesn't make you better at fighting, necessarily. It makes you better at collecting information.
Mm-hmm.
Makes you better at, you know, being able to manipulate situations. But it doesn't make you automatically more good at karate.
In general, like, all the five villages have just kind of been doing their own shit. Like, this, all of these centuries.
Mm-hmm.
They spy on each other, but that's about it. Like, that's what ninjas do, they spy on each other. But, like, otherwise, they're doing other shit. Like, the Togakushi clan literally just, like, at some point just started a business called Togakushi, and that's just what they do.
They're just called
Blue Fog, I guess.
Yeah, they're just a temp agency. Yeah. They're fine. They're like, you know what?
They're a temp agency who does assassinations on the side, and the leader of their clan is their girl boss CEO. And, you know, the Fuma, who knows whatever they're doing, their leader is, like, has weaseled his way into the government,
mm-hmm.
and is just doing who knows what, but the rest of them are just kind of hanging out in Fuma Village, doing whatever he tells them to do, but otherwise just you know, hanging out.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's why this series is kind of, I call it, like, a really big bait and switch, in that early chapters, even, like, the first couple volumes, you have this setup of, like, a more typical high school action shonen. You know, there's kind of this quirky main character, and then he has some friends and the mentor, and there's, you know, he's the chosen one, so there's bad guys after him. That's all pretty standard setup. Raime is basically fucking Sasuke from Naruto. They have that whole, like, established they have backstory.
The same backstory, yeah.
And then we don't find out Koichi's stuff till later, but, like, it's a fairly standard stuff, and then you're introduced to, like, the Fuma clan leader, who's, like, that, again, that, like, lecherous, the old, like, the master that's always in everything.
He was making me think of, like, the D. Gray Man guy.
Yeah, he reminds me of the guy from Naruto as well, like, his toad master dude.
He's all of them.
All of them. all of every version of that trope, right?
Yeah, and he sucks, and he's terrible from start to finish.
All of them suck. Every version of that trope sucks.
They all suck. Yeah. He takes it even further.
Mm-hmm.
He's just, there's nothing. I think it's just that the rest of the characters are also aware that there's nothing good about him.
They're all like, we know he sucks.
That's the thing.
We
know he sucks, but he's, like, smart, so whatever.
He's smart, he's got a lot of shit. Like, his clan is probably the biggest outside of the bad guys who we are literally fighting right now. They're good allies to have, but I don't like him as a person.
But we don't like having him here. Yeah. He's not here because we wanted to invite him to the party.
Yeah. But yeah, so I think all of those various factors kind of, like, became this maelstrom of why it just kind of didn't hit the mark when it was first being released by Yen. I also think it was one of the earlier releases, like, one of their first releases from Yen. So I think I obviously don't know how well it sold for them, but it was in the wheelhouse of what they were releasing at the time. Again, Pandora Hearts, a lot of G Fantasy series. It was definitely part of their core readership would probably be interested in that. But it also isn't that long, so I think it kind of came and went a little bit quietly. And it also didn't have, like, a super smash hit anime adaptation to boost sales that much, I don't think. So, hopefully, people listening to the podcast who haven't read or watched it will try it because it's good. Take it from us. The most unbiased media reporting there is.
Yeah. Your favorite manga news network. Yeah, anyway. Should we go on to the next question? Pick up Shonen Note when it comes out, everybody. I won't forgive you.
So Marumichi then follows that question with, to me, Nobara no O is an underrated gem, which beauty and greatness was discovered only later. Not a question, but just please tell me all of your thoughts about Miharu and Yoite and their relationship, because these two wrecked me. Yes, they wrecked me as well, and I still haven't recovered. Yeah. I hadn't recovered in, like, the 3 years since I'd first read this, and I sure wasn't recovered enough to read it this last week, but I did it anyway, and I'm still,
Yeah. I said I was reading one volume a night, because the Japanese volumes still take me, like, 2 hours to read a piece. And I said that when I was on, like, volume 7 or something, to G. And then, like, 3 days later, I was like, I finished!
You kept asking me for, like, oh, how did they translate this, like, little snippets. And I noticed, like, the parts that you're getting up to, and I'm like, oh, dear. And then one night, I just get a message, I'm sad. And I knew what had happened. And all I could do was pass on my condolences, because truly, we were all sad.
I was sad. I'm still sad. But I was really sad after I read that volume.
I remember...
She could barely contain her excitement, though. She was like, you're really gonna be sad at volume 10. And I was like, oh, that's when Yoite is gonna die. And then that's what happened, so,
But wasn't, blame G wasn't for... it even worse than what you thought? Wasn't it even worse?
It was horrible.
It was just so,
I'm really glad that I stopped at the end of volume 9. That was a good decision.
Yeah, and they just lived happily ever after and kept, like, going on travel dates. They just
continued their date.
Yep.
Yeah. They were so cute. But that's okay, because, my other OTP, got married, so. They're setting down roots together, so that's fine.
One thing I wanted to note about that, about Yoite's death in that scene and the trauma of it all as a reader, but also, like, how, like the whole series, how quietly subtle it was. It was during this huge, like, fight with all of these bad guys, and Yukimiya just lost an arm. Like, all of this stuff was happening, and it was just, like, them quietly sitting in the snow, and then all and talking about, like, a future meal, and then just one of them not being there anymore, and that just, oh man, I can't think about it without getting all choked up.
Yeah, and it's like the whole build up, because obviously you have, like, them going on their cute little travel dates together. While they're on the run from everyone who's the fucking out to get them. But also you have, like, Yoite just gradually getting weaker and weaker. And, like, the little moments of intimacy with Miharu, like, helping them around.
Mm-hmm.
But also, like, you know, the inevitability of it all, because it's, like, you know, them being able to handle, like, smaller and smaller amounts of physical activity, mm-hmm. or gradually losing their senses more and more. And it's like, it's close, I can feel it now.
When their sight
and you starts... know that's how they're feeling, too.
Yeah, and their sight starting to go, and like, I can't see you, but I know that you're, like, this is, I can see you more than I ever could before. It's just...
Yeah! They, like, their sense of taste went before their sense of smell, so it's like, you know, they keep getting, like, you know, the food that they're eating, they always, like, take such care to, like, sniff it before they mm-hmm. eat it. And it's like... Yoite, my child. Too good for this world.
And then you have this whole setup wherein Miharu has promised that he would erase Yoite's existence. They made a promise that they would do that before Yoite died. And mm-hmm. that didn't pan out quite right, but then subconsciously Miharu did erase them, but not completely, just knowing that, like, the grief would be too much, he wouldn't be able to to process it,
to handle it, because it's easier to just be apathetic. Yeah. It's a very honest regression in his character arc.
Mm.
Yeah, it's good writing. Mm-hmm. It's good writing.
And that's the thing as well, is like, Miharu has his whole life just fervently been disinterested in everything, that when presented with the absolute reality of losing something he can't be empathetic about, he has to forcefully change his brain to be, like, back in line with that empathy, mm-hmm. or that disinterest.
Apathy? Yeah, Marumichi also asks, what's our favorite character relationship in the series, not counting the one between Miharu and Yoite? So, I have my other set of boyfriends. and so, we've got Raime's brother, Raiko, who is a samurai.
He's the Itachi of the piece.
He's the Itachi. He didn't actually murder everyone. He murdered one person.
No, he murdered, like, probably a dozen people, but the one that she cares about is her uncle. And, like, also shit was going on. So, like,
Yeah. I mean, I thought it was the uncle who killed all them, but
no, because when she's
it was all, like,
when she was going through the house on fire, there's, like, two or three guys behind her that he also took out. But, like, it's not a lot. He didn't murder his whole family in the way that she thought that he murdered their whole family.
Yeah, or, like, the way that Itachi murdered his whole family. but he did murder people. This is a series about friendly murderers.
lovable murderers.
Yeah, Raiko went and joined the Grey Wolves because he feels like there's something rotten in the world of Nabari, and he thinks that a benevolent dictator like, Hattori is just what the world needs. Mm-hmm. And, as opposed to his mother, who he feels was too wishy-washy and too fence city, doing her samurai stuff to protect the balance between the world of Nabari
and the
surface world.
To be, like, the true neutral party of...
Yeah.
Of everything.
Yeah, but of course, he was a dumb kid too, just like Raime, and didn't have the full picture, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
He now works for Hattori, the leader of the Grey Wolves, as, like, basically the samurai cop. Like, he goes around and, offs the people who have been determined to be going AWOL, going against the wishes of the Grey Wolves. So that's what he does. He is an arbiter of very skewed justice,
mm-hmm.
with his little boyfriend named Gau, who... he sort of dragged into the world of Nabari. I forget, like, the specifics of Gau's backstory.
So, his mother was, I think...
Murdered.
Yeah, murdered by a guy who, like, got, I don't know, 3 years or something, got out on some technicality. And Gal was trying to get revenge. Obviously, he's like a 14-year-old, mm-hmm. or something. He can't do that. And then Raiko killed... That was his first, like, surface worlder that he killed. Mm-hmm. So allowed Gal to get his revenge. And then because he saw echoes of that from a situation he had been in before where he wasn't able to help a friend... and then so just kind of like Gal became super dedicated to this guy who, like, obviously helped change his life and saved his life as well, because he definitely would have been killed by that guy if he had tried to fight him as, like, a 13-year-old.
Yeah. But anyway, now they're cops together, but, like, Raiko does all the work because Gao can't do shit.
He does the paperwork, Ray, the most important part.
He also keeps Raiko in line. But, and they're dating. And, they, at the end of the series, they decide to, rebuild, the Shimizu clan, which is the samurai clan that Raiko and Raime are part of, with its original purpose intact, and Raime joins them as well. And it literally, the wording, at least in Japanese, is like about, like, setting down roots and establishing a family, and it's very, very gay.
Yep. I think I remember the English is like, I want to restart I want to build a family here. And it's very obviously, like, Gao's center frame straight, like, this is, there's no subtlety here.
They're gay. Janice, they're gay. and I love them.
They are very good. They're also, like, because we haven't really spoken a lot about Reiko or Gao a lot yet this episode, but they're also very fundamental to the flow of the story, and their story, like, their relationship, is quite different from, obviously, Miharu and Yoite's, but they both spanned or started from wanting to help a stranger, basically, like this,
mm-hmm.
Two people who don't know each other at all, and then through this one promise or this one action, they end up drawn together and ultimately are tied together. It's and Gao, again, although he is involved in this, he's also one of the most normal, quote-unquote, characters, wherein he doesn't come from a ninja family, he doesn't have any, like, ties to the hidden world aside from Raiko now. So he acts as this, a little bit of, again, like, that grounding foot for Raiko, who does get so focused, like, hyper-fixated on his morals and what he's been taught and trying to find his own path and like what is right and wrong thanks to his upbringing and thanks to the people that he's worked for since. And so in a similar sense, I think he serves kind of the Hanabusa role for another character who too easily does get bogged down in their own focus.
And we also do have the, you know, Raiko getting too obsessed with, these lofty, convictions of his, ultimately resulting in Gao spending a chunk of the series in a coma, and Yoite, who Raiko thought was thought of as sort of an antithesis to everything that he believes in, being the one to save Gao's life and bring him back to consciousness, which sort of rocks Raiko's world. It's a pretty straightforward arc, but it's very well executed, I would say, and just very heartwarming. And then I already mentioned, but I do really like the relationship between, our two initial little ninja friends, Koichi and Raime. Because, like, I especially like the after Koichi has told them, like, Raime and Tobari his deal, which is that he's immortal and an owl. and was a being created by the Shinra Bansho several hundred years ago. And that he's been, like, scheming with, at that point, was it Fuma that we knew of? He's scheming with everyone.
He's always scheming. They just
found out about one of them. He's always scheming. because he's mean. But, it's just really sweet because, basically we have, like, Tobari trying to, like, edge around talking to him, like, ugh, this is, But then Raime just, like, bantering with him completely normally because that's just the kind of character she is. She's very straightforward. And very much just for meeting people where they are and just, you know, she doesn't do all this sneaky shit. and, you know, Koichi thanks her for just treating him like she always has. I think he words it as, like, even knowing that nothing about me is normal, like, that you'll still talk to me normally as Aizawa Koichi. And it's just sweet. And, them, like, continuing to sort of anchor each other because they're polar opposites. Where Raime can simplify things too much, Koichi gets way too much in his own head. So, just the way that they sort of balance each other out is very sweet. Also, the way that she just is so nonchalant about the fact that he just suddenly turns into a fucking owl and flies away. Yeah. And she's like, you brat!
Oh, dear. Yeah, lots of great relationships. I also, already mentioned, I've mentioned a couple of times already, Tobari and Hanabusa. I think they have a great relationship. And it's nice to see kind of like an older established relationship doing well. We don't see a huge amount of them mm-hmm. together, but it's sweet when we do. But I also wanted to mention Yukimi and his sister. Like, obviously that's not a romantic relationship, yeah. but that's a like they're siblings. Yeah, they have a sibling relationship.
Yeah. yeah.
And I think their story is really well done. Obviously they come from like a pretty tumultuous background, like all of these characters do, and their support for each other. And their support for each other outside of, again, these, like, grand ideals that they've been following from groups that they've just found themselves in. There's just something, and also very, like, organic in how they interact with each other as brother and sister. Like, they tease each other and, you know, whatever. And he makes a point that he's not gonna hang out with his sister and her husband. He's like, I'm not living with them. I've got my own apartment. It's just, yeah, I thought it was really well done, especially in a series where there's not a huge amount of characters with siblings. I mean, there is. Obviously, there's Raiko and Raime, and then Yoite and their brother, sort of. Kind of half brother, step brother, something, some relation, but obviously Reiko and Raime, their sibling relationship is very tumultuous and takes a while for them to like start that healing process and come onto the same page and figure each other out, whereas Yukimi and his sister are like they're on the same page from the beginning, and it's nice to see that.
Yeah, and then I also just like Yukimi interacting with all of the kids that he's picked up.
Mm-hmm. All of these many children he's adopted.
These many children that he hates because he hates kids.
So many. Yeah.
But especially I like his relationship with Yoite. Mm-hmm. I like how willing he is to just sort of, even if he won't admit it, just like his willingness to meet Yoite where Yoite is at.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause, you know, if you reach out, if you try to go too far too fast with Yoite, you're just going to drive them away.
Mm-hmm.
I think Yukimi is just the perfect balance that they need. So... I also like the leader of Togakushi.
Ah.
Her relationship with her company.
Yeah. It's
so sweet. Not with the Fuma guy, Kato, but with the rest of them.
Mm-hmm.
And like the fact that like all of her underlings are so like ready and like ecstatic to invite her back, even after realizing that she knows all of their deepest, darkest secrets because she's been violating their headspace for years.
Mm-hmm.
But they're like, no, you're a great boss! Come on back!
We love you! Please don't change!
We love you! Yeah, she's such a girl boss.
She is. She absolutely is. I also think the relationship between the Hakutaku is pretty interesting. Like, they have the same goal, but they're not necessarily aligned in everything. And, they bully each other, and I think that's funny.
Yeah. Well, just like a cat and a bird, right?
Who would have thought?
Shichima's an interesting character.
Mm.
She's a bit hard to get a grasp on compared to some of the others, because she's, like, so inhuman, mm-hmm. but... She is an interesting element.
I think that's it for Marumichi's questions, and thank you for all of those. And I think we'll wrap up with the many questions from Stories on Shelves, storage shelves, like we typically do.
Our unofficial podcast. Moderator, thank you, as always.
We've already spoken about So their first question is, any fond memories associated with the series? I mean, I don't know if it's a fond memory. I'll always remember the Funimation trailer and, like, it playing before so many things. Like,
That's what I was gonna say.
I'm pretty sure, like,
yeah,
probably all of the original, like, 2003 Fullmetal Alchemist DVDs had that on there. Like, Holic had that. So many shows that I watched definitely had that trailer on that. Their discs. And, I'll just always remember that that pencil thing and the kind of, like, spit take that the trailer does with it.
I just, I think I'll always remember flipping through it and not knowing, not having any idea what was going on in the Yen Plus magazines that I used to collect. That would be the ultimate power move, I think, is, like, reading Nabari no O exclusively through old issues of Yen Plus. Just, like, refusing to collect the series in Tonka Bones and exclusively buying it through Yen Plus.
So much paper. So much paper. The other thing... This is, like, a fun memory, sort of. It's a memory I associate with Nabari no O because, for some reason, it's very vividly stuck in my mind. But back in the day, when I used to watch, like, manga collection videos on YouTube, prior to, like, this current boom, or even the, like, several past, this was before I was doing videos, so this is a while ago, but there was a girl who was showing off her manga collection. It was probably like the video itself was probably 3 or 4 years old at that point. And she had a full set of Nabari no O. And she was, you know, talking about how much she loved it and blah, blah, blah. And it just really jumped out to me that all of the spines of the series, they have like a character profile, like the profile of their face on it. And then the last two volumes, so they're all facing like the one direction. And then the last two volumes, it has Miharu and Yoite looking at each other on the spines. And yeah, I was wrecked. So... And that, I think, also, like, encouraged me to be like, hey, maybe I should try this. It would be several more years before I did, but I don't know, random girl on the internet who probably doesn't make videos anymore and hasn't for close to 10 years, your collection of Nabari no O, it really had a very positive influence on me later buying it in the future. So...
Your impact.
Stories on Shelves' next question is, what moments in the series were most impactful for you? I think we spoke quite a bit about this.
We answered that already.
And then, so the next question is, which characters are your favorite design-wise?
That'd be the Hakutaku for me.
The white hair and red eyes and turning into animals.
More like when they, like, yeah, when they turn into animals. I like the feathers, and I like the... I like Shijima's design.
Her little...
It's cool. It's probably the most unique. I feel like everyone just kind of looks like a guy in the Nabari no O.
Yeah.
Like, they don't look bad or anything, but they just look like... You know, folks.
They look like people. They don't look like manga characters, necessarily. Like, if you're walking down a street, nothing would make, like, Tobari jump out at you as, like, oh, this is a guy who is definitely from a fictional story. No one has really wild, weird hair, aside from the one guy who dyes his hair. Nobody wears, like, any really unruly and over-the-top outfits, again, aside from the guy who does, because that's just his fashion.
Yeah, because he does, because that's his thing. He just is that guy.
But also, 9 times out of 10, he's just, like...
They are all wearing horribly unruly unruly fashions. Gee. They're in the year 2009, regrettably.
Yes, but it was for 2009 very, very normal for everyone to be wearing Hot Topic. I think you know that, right? And thus, if they're...
Like the horrible baggy bootcut pants.
Yes. With probably chains, definitely ear cuffs, and maybe a vest. So, like...
Oh my god. Triggered. Like Tobari's, like, Visual K hairstyle.
Exactly. And keep in mind, Tabari's like 26. He definitely would still be dressed like that. This is not unreasonable.
Is he that young?
Yes.
Because, like, Hanabusa's 35.
Hanabusa is in her 40s, I think. And...
45?
I don't know if she's 45, but she's definitely...
I guess he...
He got there...
Yeah, I guess he would be.
Yeah, because he got there at, like 16, and it's been 10 years. He's younger than I am, Ray. Yeah. This man...
I can...
Who also hasn't had, like, any guardianship since 16, because he's stuck in a country without parents. His grandpa just died. So he's had to fend for himself for freaking 10 years. What else would he be wearing? How did he become a teacher? How did...
Because he can speak English. What do you do in Japan if you can speak English better than you can speak Japanese?
But he hadn't...
You become an English teacher.
But he was 16. Like, he hadn't even graduated high school. I don't know.
I mean, you just have to get a teaching degree.
I mean, I guess...
Like, Bantan, he probably went to high school and then went to teaching school.
I guess Bantan's also small enough that, like, they're not gonna ask questions. They're like, oh, we need an English teacher.
I work with a lot of teachers who are, like, 22, 23.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm not questioning the fact that he's a teacher at, like, that young, but I'm questioning how, like, at 16, without any parents or anything, he's just like, well, I guess I just need to survive, and, he stayed alive over 10 years. I don't know, he's done pretty well for himself, all things considered.
He seems like a pretty average English teacher. Hey, G.
Yes?
Which covers and chapter title pages did you like the most?
I like the last cover, which is Miharu. I liked the... there's one with I think there's one with Raime and Raiko on it.
Raiko, yeah.
I like that one. There's a lot of very beautiful color pages, and of course the freaking color pages in the last volume, oh my god, just kill me. When Miharu has, like, memories.
Yeah,
but also the freaking color fold out at the end of chapter or volume 10 or 11, that's just like Yoite in the forest in the snow, and I'm like, hey, thanks, cool, I'm not recovered yet. there's a lot of nice Nabari color art. I would say all of my favorite stuff comes from later, because early stuff, the characters definitely look more like Hot Topic noodles.
Oh my goodness, yeah.
With, like, no muscles.
There's a lot of, like, weird, sharp angles.
giant shoes.
Yeah.
They're going through their Kingdom Hearts
era. Giant shoes. Kingdom Hearts era. Yeah. Yeah, they definitely, you know, come into their art more later on, and I feel like the compositions get more interesting as well. Mm-hmm. There's one that I really like that's Miharu and Yoite just, like, hanging out, looking out over the sea at sunset.
Mm-hmm.
That one's really nice. I like a lot of the group shots as well later on in the series. They're just, I mean, if you've read anything Kamatani, you know that their color art is breathtaking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
there's a group shot where Miharu is holding Yui, like the cat, and then they're like the scarf's there, and then like other people are in the background. I don't remember what volume that's from, but it was nice. And yeah, I mean, if you like Kamatani's artwork, just by the way, and you are wanting some sort of art book or whatever, the art book, if you can get it from Mandarake or like a Japanese store, is so cheap, guys. Like, it's so cheap. You can get a new secondhand one for like 900 yen. It's so cheap. You can get the, like, fancy Animate Limited one for, like, 15 bucks. It's so cheap, and obviously there's, like, postage and handling and all that as well, but compared to, like, what some art books go for, crazy money, it's very, very affordable, and there seems to always be copies floating around. Don't buy them from, like, eBay resellers or anything, because that's obviously a grift, but like, if you can get it from Mandarake or CD Japan or somewhere, it's quite good value for money for anyone interested.
Also, if you like Kamatani's color illustration, I don't know yet if it's going to be kept in the English edition, but every volume of Shonen Note has a stunningly beautiful full-color wraparound cover, so.
I would hope they keep it. I would be really, like, sad if Kodansha decided to hurt me in this way.
Look forward to that, hopefully.
Mm.
One of the covers also says gay rights. There's a big rainbow on it. So.
Oh, nice.
Wrap around.
How would you say Kamatani's art style changed as the series progressed?
Things get a lot less wordy. So that's the biggest thing for me, is that I think they got... I mean, obviously part of it is that, like, they've already gotten all the lore explanations out of the way, so they can kind of slow down a bit. But a big part of it is also that I think they were getting more confident in their ability to, you know, tell a story visually without requiring so much explanation of what's going on in the speech bubbles. So that was definitely a big relief for me reading, you know, slogging through the volumes in Japanese. Getting to another big speech bubble where the speech is all just, like, in, like, 7-point font or something.
Yeah,
I'm just like, oh, God.
So much!
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you really start to see around, like, volume 6, 7, a lot more of their development of what we now see as, like, very classic Kamatani style of these... just whether it's 1 or 2 page spreads where it's just only, there's not a word to be said, right? Or very minimal dialogue and just completely a scene being evoked through this metaphorical artwork of characters like sinking into, you know, dark water or like lost in the woods or what, like there's a lot of that kind of symbolism happening the more you get further into it. And I think that's become kind of a core part of Kamatani style now, of these...
The string of fate, like, connecting to another side that he can't see. That was really evocative to me.
Yes, yeah. And also, like, obviously, with any manga, like, character designs clean themselves up a little bit over time. Art styles are honed. These characters don't necessarily look as much like Hot Topic rejects as they do in the beginning. It's just overall a bit more polished. A lot more happening with, like, backgrounds and stuff as well. A sense of place. Yeah. So, I would say there's definitely a huge art improvement and evolution over the course of the series, which is what we just continue to see over the course of all of their series, right? And this...
Also, they keep drawing cats, and the cats at the beginning of the series look weird, and the cats at the end look very cute, so... There was a lot of artistic evolution happening on the cat illustration front as well.
Yep.
Very important.
The most important element is, of course, the cats. And then our final question, and I think it's an important question to bring up, because we've had a lot of praises for the series so far, but Stories on Shelves, this last question is, any critiques for the series?
Well, other than how dense it is at the beginning, which can be a bit of a slog, my main thing is fight scenes. I could not tell what was happening a lot of the time. Who'd just been shot, how grave the wound was. Time is difficult to figure out in the middle of a fight scene. So I just... kind of feel like that's not necessarily Kamatani's forte as a creator. But it's also not, like, the main thing in Nabari no O, so I didn't think that it was, like, a crippling failure or anything. Yeah. I just was always like, It's just kind of skimming through the fight scenes, like, okay, who's dead?
Yeah, a little bit hard to follow. I remember, having reread it, a lot of the fights were easier to follow, obviously, because I knew, like, who was getting hurt or, like, what was necessarily happening. I'm pretty sure the first time I read it, I, like, almost totally missed that Yukimi lost an arm the first time. Like,
yeah.
I was like, what? Oh. Yeah. But now, like...
I kept forgetting, too.
If you're aware of it, and, like, obviously that's a testament to the action not being... that good. Again, this isn't a series that has a lot of bombastic action anyway, and it's such a small part of the series that I think a learning that Kamatani took from this is that action is not their forte, and therefore they haven't done another action shonen.
Which is so valid.
Absolutely so valid. I will also say that story-wise, I think the CASA, which are like the government team of bad guys, are a little bit like they're not utilized well. They're a bit little bit like not unneeded. We already had so many characters that they don't really add too much. Aside from, like, oh, we need more people to fight when we already have a backlog of, like, all of these characters already. They just felt unnecessary. And it's not like... They didn't ruin the series. But I don't think they were utilized very strongly. And they were kind of a late addition. And they just kind of existed.
Yeah. They weren't all that interesting of villains either. You know, the creepy twins who keep... like, confusing themselves for each other is, like, I've seen it before, and more fun. You know? And, the others just didn't really get enough to do to even have much of a, like a shtick.
Uh-huh.
It's not exactly the Akatsuki over here.
And again, at the length that the series is, like, they didn't... I honestly think without all of that, and they did drive some of this story forward, but you could have done a lot of that without introducing new characters. But I think also at that point, like, so many characters had turned to the quote-unquote good side that they're like, we need villains. Like, we need bad guys to fight. Yeah. But we could have just had some grunts, like some more different Grey Wolves that we didn't know. Mm. They would have been fine.
Yeah, or they could have, like, I mean, you could make the secretary a fighter if you wanted to. We already knew her. Just give her, you know, maybe she fights with fans or something.
Yeah.
And then, I also like thinking about Casa. We do have the addition of Yukimi, who obviously deals with, missing an arm, but I think, like, I wish there was perhaps more representation of, like, disabled characters that are not connected to the use of the murder power.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. It's like, you know, the one character in a wheelchair is in a wheelchair because they keep murdering people and they're a fucking monster.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, okay. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know. Which is, you know, obviously it's not like an on-purpose thing, right? It's just kind of like...
It's like, this is a power that has degenerative things and... Oh no, we don't have, like, really any other disabled characters that are not evil, like, well, not evil. Yoite isn't evil, but, like, doesn't have this horrific power that literally allows you to kill anyone, anywhere, whenever you want, and also slowly breaks your own life energy down or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, maybe just... It's just a symptom of, like, not really even thinking about physical disability until you need a visual representation of this superpower you've come up with. And it's just, you know, it was 2009, and I feel like in 2022 we can do better now, so...
Yes, indeed.
That's all.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything, like, majorly horrendous. Like, there isn't anything in the series that I would say would stop me from recommending it to someone.
Yeah.
It's not like, no, oh, not really. Like, it's good, but also, like, oh, there's some problematic things said about... I don't know, women or something.
No, like, it's not, it's fine, but it's also, like, you know, it is a critique I have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know.
Because
we should always be trying to be better.
Exactly. But this isn't, like, a Bakuman, where I'm like, this, nobody should read this, it's horrendous, and, like, if you found good things out of it, like, I'm really glad for you, and that's not to say that there isn't good things or ideas that were good, but it's also, like, far more harmful than good, and don't inflict that on yourself. This is not that. And also, I wouldn't say, like, read this if you're wanting Our Dreams at Dusk, because it isn't that. No. It has a lot of similar themes. It has, obviously, Kamitani's, you know, writing styles and ideas and topics that they want to cover. And this is the same creator, but, like, if you're wanting... especially, like, explicitly queer representation... especially diverse representation that Our Dreams at Dusk had,
yeah.
this isn't, it doesn't, it, that's not that, what this is, nope. Right? Like, it's what, like, it's very, very good for the genre, the demographic, the, you know, whatever else that it's been placed in. I would say that it stands out from a lot of its peers. I wouldn't say it's the best thing that Kamatani has written, having not read all of their titles, mind you. But it's, if you're a fan of Kamatani, you should read it and or watch it in some capacity.
Mm-hmm.
If only to get an idea of, like, where they started and how they've evolved. And also, like, if you like a good, you know, action drama, it's good. It's good. It has great characters. It's good.
Yeah. It was a lot, like, I was expecting something that was going to be, like, you know, a fun research project as someone who is a fan of Kamatani's later stuff, mm-hmm. but it's, like, legitimately really good. So, like, I don't have any issues just recommending it pretty much without caveats.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you like Kamatani stuff, I still think Our Dreams at Dusk is their most perfect work,
mm-hmm.
quote unquote, that I've read from them. The closest to being flawless. But, like, Nabari no O is still, like, it's really good. And Shonen Nut is my favorite, so. But, yeah, I don't know. I feel like it's good. It's good. And my AC has been off this entire time, and I'm getting hot.
Oh, no. Well, I think with that, it's a unanimous recommendation from both Ray and I, and I'm very happy that Ray did enjoy it as much as she seemingly did, and hopefully we've encouraged you all, if you haven't read the series before, to try it. Next month is we're doing a genre spotlight, if that makes sense. We are doing autobiographical / memoir manga. So this is going to be including stuff like my lesbian experience with loneliness.
Blank Canvas?
Yeah, Blank Canvas. I'm sure we'll talk about the at this point, like, 36 memoirs that have come out from both Yen and Seven Seas. Mm-hmm. Be sure to send us your questions either on Twitter. You can at me directly. That's at gReads, @GEReads. Or you can leave them in the comment section down below if you're listening or watching this on YouTube. Remember, you can always find us on pretty much every podcasting platform. So if you do enjoy us, you can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Anchor FM, somewhere else. I'm sure all the places. Or, of course, YouTube on my YouTube channel, Simply G. Thank you, everyone, as always, for sending in your amazing questions. We got so many. We were kind of not thinking that we get a lot this episode, but of course our dedicated question senders have our backs at all times. We are very, very glad to have you.
So grateful.
Very grateful. But if you do you have any questions for us, be sure to send them in those places. Also, follow Ray on her social medias because she is wonderful. She has a YouTube channel, Whimsical Pictures. I don't know when the last time was that you posted, but even her old videos are amazing, so go watch them. Or, of course, you can follow her on Twitter at Whimsical Pix. That is P-I-X. It's great and a good time. And, yeah, all of those things.
A lot of theater girls.
A lot of theater girls. At all times. all of the theater girls, and then, yeah. like, sometimes manga hot takes, if there's some particular
yeah.
juicy discourse, but...
or monkeys.
Or, how could I have forgotten the monkeys? so, honestly, sign up, follow Ray for monkeys, follow me for lizards, and then just ignore all of the rest of the shit that we post, because it's not important.
Yeah, it's not important.
At all. Thank you guys so
much. Stan Asumi Ryo, please.
So thank you guys so, so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. I will catch you in the next episode, and bye till then.
Bye, guys.
Bye.